accession number 18463, reel 11.
Dunbarret, reel 11.
This had been the village that the welcoming party had come out from, down to the banks of the Chung Chung River, and helped us ashore and cheered us and goodness knows what else at that time. So one hopes that they were not in these villages. Presumably, the expectation was that was the forming up place for the attack which was expected on our left flank. We still didn't know at our level that the Americans had been driven back across the river at Anju, and in fact we were just literally in an enclave. It's said later that the ration corporal, when he went to draw the rations for the battalion, a senior officer said, "Don't bother, they're cut off, they're lost." But of course, we all know ration corporals are far more important figures than generals and things like that, so he collected the rations and brought them along to us. Although we were a bit short, I think we were on 1 in 3 at this time. He didn't get all he wanted. Anyway, the following day, which would be the morning of the 7th, we had word that we were going to move forward to assist the Australians. Now, I thought the battalion was going to move forward, and it was only afterwards I found it was only B Company. It was probably about 10 o'clock that morning. We went down on the road. Might have been a little bit later, couldn't say. And there was a few tanks, three or four tanks, and the carriers were there, the MMG carriers, and they lifted us forward to the place where the railway line that goes into Pak Chon crosses the road. The Aussies were there, and they were all packing up, and they were just moving on. And they were very quiet, a little bit subdued. They didn't want to talk about anything, you know. Well, I thought, well, I suppose you wouldn't when you know, we're probably the same when we're just about to do some operation or other. Anyway, they cleared off, left us there, and we had to take over, our platoon took over a company position. And the first thing that astounded us was the stuff, the gear that they'd left about, because, I mean, we were always short-handed with the equipment and stuff. They left all these trip flares, English-type trip flares around all over the place. There were even mosquito nets, and I picked up a Mauser pistol, wooden holster, which is they use for a butt, and there were Bren gun barrels thrown in the stream, which was actually frozen solid at this time. It's very, very cold now. And there was a lot of stuff about, a great heap, pyramid of greatcoats, and a great pile of kit bags, which we presume they would come along and pick up later. Anyway, we took over, and they went off a bit smartly and set the section position. Now, I had my LMG on the road, looking north towards Pak Chon, and then I only had I can't really be sure, because people came and went. I was always short of people, so people came and went. I never had a 2OC, but I might have had 4 pits at that time out on the right, on a little stream bed, which is overlooking, on the other side of the stream, is the railway embankment, which goes right round into Pak Chon. It's not actually as it's shown on the map. It's as it's shown on a diagram of mine. I have no idea why that is, but lots of the positions of places in Korea were completely wrong. 600 yards out was nothing. Anyway, we dug in, or we didn't have to dig in, because the trenches had all been dug by the Aussies. And I placed the LMG on the road. That was the three tanks that remained with us. The carriers went off back again, and we were literally out in the blue. We thought the battalion had come up, but as I say, it was only B Company that actually come up. And things were pretty quiet. In fact, they were very quiet. And we settled down. Shortly after this, 2 anti-tank guns came up, and they literally extended air line. They were more or less shield to shield, looking down the road from Pak Chon, where we knew there were tanks in Pak Chon and around that area. And the expectation was they'd do a sortie down the road. So we got talking to the gunners. The second time we met them, we saw them on the Nakdon, actually, but this is the first time we really had a good time to have a chat with them. And they were looking forward to these T-34s coming down the road, and I think they thought we were a bit wimpy because we didn't want them to come down the road too much. And they said that they'd not had a shot at a T-34 yet, and they were looking forward to it because they'd fired at a stationary one, you know, knocked out one from the front, and it'd gone through the front armour, the thickest armour that you could think of, through the crew compartment, and then passed directly down the engine, through the engine and out the back. So they said there's not too much chance of any of them, you know, overrunning you. Well, we still didn't fancy it too much. We thought perhaps they could stay where they were. And the day went on. It's quite a quiet day. Nothing much happened. That night was getting colder now. It's getting very cold now. We're in BD, battle dress that is, and winter underwear, I suppose. I can't really remember about the winter underwear. We may have been, we may not have been. And the only additional clothing we had was a American field jacket that had been issued back just north of Yongyu at Sakchon, just there where we linked up with the airborne, an American field jacket. Very nice field jacket it was, very comfortable. And that was the only extra equipment we had. Didn't have air great coats. Anyway, that night, when I was doing my stag, I went over and thought, well, I might try one of these Australian overcoats. I haven't collected them yet. I could always slip it back on the pile. So I got one out and put it on. It was fairly comfortable, actually, a bit tight over the field jacket. Felt in the pockets. There was a tin in each pocket, tin of sea ration. We were short of sea rations. And when I got them out, they were the favourite ones, the fruit, two tins of fruit. So I thought, ooh, all right, here. So I went through the others, and every one of these greatcoats had two tins of fruit in, or biscuits, all the best stuff, all the stuff that we always used to eat first. As soon as it came up, we'd eat this on a premise, if you're not there tomorrow, no one else is going to have it. And it was no food, all the special things, the cream, the custard creams and the chocolate and stuff like that. So I thought, well, this is all right. I'll pop over here every night, and if they don't collect their greatcoats, I'll have a little delve in the pockets. Put the greatcoat back, and the night passed off without any incident whatsoever. Stand to as normal. A little bit later, Albert Critchley, who is our platoon commander, very good platoon commander, one of the best, and he came over and he said, well, you're staying on the road with your section. Hold the road. We've got to go back and do a demonstration on a ridge which was just to our rear. And the two sections and platoon HQ then passed us through, went off down the road, and they were walking all over the road and kicking the dust up and stopping and drinking from their water bottles. And we, watching them, we said, well, no one, everybody will know that's they're putting that on. That it just didn't look right to us from a distance. Anyway, they went up, and then they turned left, which is east across the road, across this little ridge, and started to dig and put white towels out on the bushes to dry and lay their beds and things like that, because they weren't really doing that. They were just digging scrapes, throwing all the spoil down the front, so it showed. So whilst the 50% of them are doing this demonstration thing up on the ridge, spread out right along the ridge, about a company length, I guess. The rest of them were on the other side of the road, just below the ridge, digging a position there. And they really made a real state of this. If we were abused, they said, no one will believe that. I mean, even green troops wouldn't do some of the things they did. And we watched them. And nothing much happened. Nobody fired at them. Nothing happened whatsoever. And at stand two, no, nothing happened. The gunners were also being used as observers. Everybody was being used as an observer, naturally. Anyway, it got dark. Now, I thought it was perhaps just after stand two, but according to the war diary, I now know that it was the following morning, about 3 o'clock in the following morning, that suddenly they opened fire, these tanks up in Pakchon, I would guess 4 or 5 of them. So the shells were screaming over the top of us, low down. We were hugging the ground there. And looking back at where this platoon was, where they'd been doing their demonstration, They'd left fires, incidentally, burning up on the crest there. And it was absolutely direct on. And we could see the fires going up and the bushes flying about all over the place. And we heard later that some of the shells just skimmed across the top and went into D Company's position as well. So there really was a fuss. And it went on. I really don't know. It's very difficult under shell fire to know how long it was. I would have said it was 10 minutes to a quarter of an hour, and then suddenly stopped. And we went and had a little chat, or I went and had a little chat with the gunners, and they said that they estimated there were about five tanks, most of them firing from Pak Chon, but one or maybe two on a ridge on the left-hand side firing from there. And it all settled down, so it had been quite effective, because the following morning the platoon came back with their tails in the air because they hadn't had any casualties and they thought they'd been a great success. The two sections, that is, and platoon HQ came back. And that day the aircraft came in again and attacked the positions where they'd been identified, because it wasn't only us observing. The battalion farther back had been able to look right over our heads into Pak Chon, and they reckoned that they'd found about four or five tank positions, and hopefully they were giving them a bit of stick during the day. And we were back to normal again, fairly quiet, not too much happening. And I was off duty at this time and sort of just trying to get a bit of rest. And one of the chaps from the position on the road, on the LMG position on the road, came running over and said, "We've got a lot of civilians here, and they won't let us. The men will let us search them. The woman won't." And I said, "Oh, come on, for goodness sake, get a grip of yourselves. Go to the searcher." "No, she won't allow us to search her at all." So I, very brave and bold, I went along there, and I wasn't brave enough to search her first. So I began to search the men, and they all held their hands up and giggling and laughing, and I was searching them. And I left the girl to last. She was quite a proud-looking girl, I must admit. Well-dressed, obviously a little bit grubby, as we all were, with her hair in a bun, and very smart young lady, and quite tall. So I went and told her to raise her arms up in the air, and I would, she started screaming and playing about there, and I sort of grabbed her and she pulled away and all that. And to be quite honest, now in retrospect, I think maybe she did have something she didn't want me to find out. But it couldn't have been very big. It could only have been a pistol or a grenade or something like that. And I'll be honest, I chickened out. I wasn't brave enough to force her to allow me to search her. And we let them all go. And the men all giggled and laughed and waved at us. And off they went. And I think that was, in retrospect, I suspect she must have had something hidden there. Though I couldn't think how she could have done, because she was not. They, none of them had any sort of overcoats or anything like that. But it must have been something pretty small that she didn't want us to find. They went on their way, and we just reported a number of civilians come through. I didn't tell them I'd searched the girl. And we went back to the business again. And shortly after that, this might have been the following day. Days get confused here. But the next call I had down to the post, they stopped a couple of civilians in with a bullock loaded up with stuff, both in civilian clothes. And they passed through, incidentally, presumably passed through a forward post that we got out forward of us. And so it seemed that they would have searched them, and didn't seem too good. So they just stopped them. And suddenly one of them apparently, this is the story I heard, they'd run around the back of the bullock and he started to pull a long rifle out of the bullock. So they weren't too happy about this, the lads, so they grabbed them and they got them on the ground there when I got round there. And we unloaded the bullock, and there was two rifles, no uniforms, a artillery protractor, and one or two other things that made it look as if they were some sort of OP party that was trying to pass through our lines. So we said to them, that you're guerrillas of some sort and you're going to be shot, or you will be shot eventually. And they weren't too pleased about that. Anyway, Jimmy Wilde came over, took them away, and I saw no more of them. I don't know what happened to the bullock and the bits and pieces, actual fact, because they were just passing stuff. But Jimmy took him over to a house, and then he said, "Well, you're not in uniform. You're obviously soldiers." And they kept saying, "Not soldiers this week. Soldiers last week. Not soldiers this week." And we said, "Well, you've got rifles, so..." Or they said, "You've got rifles, so you're only your soldiers this week, as far as we're concerned." And Jim took one of them, said, "Right, we're taking him away to be shot," to his friend. Took him round the corner, fired a round in the ground, and left a guard with this chap just round the corner of the house. Went back to the other one and said, "Well, it's your turn now. You know, your mate's gone now, so you're safe. If you want to tell us something, you can." "No, soldier this week, not so..." "Very brave lads," they were, "very brave lads indeed. Soldier this last week, not soldier this week." So he took him round the corner, and when they saw each other, they were both still alive, they flung their arms around each other and were really quite excited. And they were then brought back to me, because there wasn't... I mean, we weren't into doing anything else to them. And they'd sent off for a rock unit to come and pick them up. And they were just squatting down just behind my LMG post. No trouble whatsoever, just waiting to be taken away. And a jeep came up with a driver from, I suppose, from battalion. And he came over and had a little chat with him. He said, "Oh, I could make them talk." And I was just sitting there sort of watching all this. He wasn't talking directly to me. He was talking to my section, who apparently knew him. I didn't know. And he said, "I can make them talk." So he got out a carbine bayonet and slipped it between their fingers as if he was going to try and break their fingers. I said, no, none of that. I don't want any of that. These guys are suffering enough. You know, stop that." And he wasn't too happy, actually, but he stopped. And we were feeding them and giving them cups of coffee and things like that. And the lads... I didn't smoke, but I mean, the lads were giving them cigarettes and things like that. Shortly after that, a jeep load of fairly fierce-looking rocks came up, well-dressed, unusually well-dressed for rocks. Might have come from Brigade HQ, for all I know. And they carted them both away, and to be honest, I don't know what happened to them from then on. I mean, I'd like to think they lived, because they were good lads. And that was the end of our little saga there. In the meantime, the patrol that was forward, we couldn't quite understand how they've managed to apparently walk down the road, because we had this sniper section patrol forward, and they presumably must have walked straight through them. But you have to bear in mind, the snipers go to ground, and they don't look for trouble. They're sort of looking out for things. Anyway, when they came back that evening, the sniper sergeant, and we knew some of the snipers, or the lads knew them, I knew them as well, and they got chatting. And after they'd gone, they were saying that they hadn't got a clue. They had never seen these people, so I don't know whether they came across on a track from a side, which they may have done. But I don't know why, but my lads didn't have much confidence in the patrol commander that was doing this on a daily basis. But I didn't know him, and I guess they'd got something from the chaps they knew. Anyway, the following day, when the patrol came through, they came through each morning just after stand two and went off down the road with the sniper section. And they stopped at the American tanks, and we could see a lot of chat and talk and what have you going on. They went on their way, and we found out later that one of the tanks was supposed to go forward with them, and he'd refused. He said he wasn't going forward while there were hold-down tanks in Pakcho on the road, Marmy Mine and all the rest of it. But he wouldn't go forward, so they had to go forward on their own. And during the course of that day, the Mustangs were attacking the tanks again. They're quite a long way from them, I'm quite sure. But that evening when they came back, they reckoned the Mustangs had shot them up, and then the Aussies had mortared them. But we found that a little bit suspect. Anyway, they went off back. And the next day, we... had a patrol. We had to do the patrol. My section had to take the patrol out. I suppose the snipers had been sent off somewhere else or something. But we took the patrol out, and I was given a signaller from Company HQ, and I took my complete section out. Not complete. I left two men on the post, so we were, you know, two less. I suppose we were about five or six plus a signaller, something like that. Got no 2IC, which is always a problem. went down to the position where we were supposed to be, which was right where the tank that had burned out was, and we found a little gully there. It was obvious that that's where the snipers had laid up because there was some evidence, you know, sea ration evidence there, fairly clean, but just one or two little bits, so we guess that's where they must have been. And we lay in this little dry ditch, which had a little pipe under the road, which presumably took the water off down into a gully on the right-hand side. And I thought, well, I'd better have a quick look round now and see what's going on. So I went first to the lorries, left the section and the Sigma, reported what I was going to do back to company, and went forward and had a look at the lorries. And they were brand new lorries. I think they must have been Australian. They were ours were absolutely dilapidated, really clapped out things. And they looked as if you could get in them and drive them. They were empty, but they were angles across the road. And the tank was completely burnt out, and the 50 caliber on the top was still in very good condition, but it wasn't any good to us because it had no ammunition and it was too heavy for us to carry. All the small arms had burnt out, and the inside of the tank burnt out, and she was sort of slightly forward in the ditch. So I went out in a sweep then, went through where the Australian company had been, who had been protecting this particular area, and each of the trenches had a 36 grenade on the top, absolutely frozen solid into the deck. So I kicked a few of them off and into the deck and took a few of them away with me. Then nothing else, no food or anything there. Up to the left was a Chinese in the old padded uniform, dead. And rather strangely, there was a sand-coloured anti-tank gun down in the dip there, which I'd not seen before, and it had been abandoned by the Aussies. So I went over to that and had a look, and the optical sight had been taken and all the ammunition. So I guess they got it down there, and then when the attack came, they couldn't get it out, and now they presumably had abandoned it. Perhaps the lorries up on the road were their vehicles, I don't know. So I went off around in a sweep. It was on my own, so I really wanted to stay within sight of the patrol. And I came across a little pile of bodies, I guess about five of them, in civilian clothes. Their weapons that they'd had been taken, and they were laid across a Japanese carbine with the old folding bayonet, the one that folds back to the barrel. And I thought, well, I better mark them, you know, somebody will want to bury them one day. So I went to pick the rifle up, but they were laid across it. And I gave it an almighty wrench, and they came up with a terrible cracking sound, and I got the rifle, unfolded the bayonet and stuck it in the ground, butt uppermost, to show that there were bodies there. And I started then to swing round, and I found a long gully, and I thought, well, I better not go down there, it looks a bit dodgy, because it was full of foliage and things, and we didn't really know where the Chinese were at this time. So I took a big sweep back, still staying in line with the in under, so that they could see me, the patrol could see me. As I'm circling round, I saw another couple of bodies. And incidentally, from here, I could see why the tanks had not fired on us, had fired on the demonstration right back. You couldn't see any of our people, couldn't see our trenches, there was no smoke, and I could only, because I knew, I could just see the tops of the three tanks, but you really couldn't see. It was we were very well dug in, as it happens. Anyway, I circled on round, and I came up to these two bodies. It was a very terrible sight, actually. They were dressed in like their Sunday best, black and white. Young man, young woman, good clothing, silky black clothing, white cotton stuff. Could I stop for a minute? Yes, these two young people were lying on their backs, holding hands, and they were laid out like two stars. Arms out above their heads, legs spread apart, just like two stars laying on the ground there. And I didn't have the courage to look and see whether they'd been shot in the front or the back. There was no sign of shots in the front. So I suspect they'd been sent out from the little village that was behind there as a decoy. And they'd probably been shot down from there. I can't think that the Aussies would have shot them down. They had no reason to. But why they were in their Sunday best, I just... cannot possibly imagine. Went on then, and I saw what I thought was a sack wedged behind a tree. And I went over to that, and unfortunately it wasn't a sack, it was a burnt body, a most terribly burnt body. And there was the hair had not, and the hair, there were no clothes on it. And everything, the fingers and toes and things had all gone. And I couldn't tell if it was a man or a woman. And the flesh was like pork, like a big pork joint, and it cracked open, and there was this white pork-like crackling it was, and the hair on the head was there, but it was, in fact, I touched the hair on the head, and it just fell away, and hair in the other parts of the body was still there, but it just crumpled when, as soon as you touched it. Went back then to the under the road, and went back down the road to the patrol position. And I told them to report that it all seemed clear on the right flank, and I was preparing then to take somebody with me and do a sweep on the left. But just at that moment, we spotted a group of people coming from the right flank, from where the Chinese flank that was, coming across at a little village that was north of us called Kujin. We'd been through it before a couple of times. And they went into this village and vanished from view. Shortly after that, some civilians started to come down the road. So we thought, well, it didn't look much like civilians, but they were coming down the road. And I had an Australian hat. I got it from somewhere. I had no idea where. And I said to them, well, I'll stand up on the road, put the Aussie hat on, and see what the reaction is. Got out on the road, and they stopped immediately and went into the ditch and looked a bit frightened. I didn't know whether that was because they'd seen me or because they'd seen the Aussie hat. I couldn't really tell. Anyway, I took the hat off and stood up there and beckoned them on down to me. And they came forward, and we kept them covered. And they were just a group of civilians coming from Kujin, presumably, or Pakchon, one of these places. And the usual sign was, if civilians were using the road, that the road was open and the enemy had withdrawn. And we were a little bit suspicious of this, because they could have sent them down to have a look at us. They went on through. We warned the company that they were coming on through. And I guess about half an hour after this, we saw the... I decided not to do my patrol to the left flank now, because things were getting just a little bit interesting. And shortly after this, we saw the people that we'd seen coming from the right flank are coming down the road fast toward us on each side of the road. I guess they must have been in about platoon strength, walking fast, very fast, coming down towards us. And I didn't like the look of this. Well, none of us liked the look of this very much. So I got the LMG out on the left flank as a cut-off, and I got out on the road, and as they got closer, I did the old policeman thing, you know, the old arm up in the air, and they took no notice whatsoever of me. They just went, kept marching on. And one of them waved to me and smiled, and I began to think we were in a little spot of bother, and these were perhaps North Koreans about to sort of take us out. But they came down through us, went straight on through, and they were armed with burp guns and stuff like that. But that wasn't unusual. The South Koreans were armed with anything that they could pick up, and they had what we called, a lot of them had what we called gook boots, which were the old basketballs. Again, the South Koreans were like that.